I'd lead off tonight by just saying that this is only our third night in the actual text. It's the fourth of the classes that we've had in the book, to count that, those introductory pages, and fifth or sixth as we went through, you know, several classes in preparation even for them. But this early in our study now of the chronological study Bible, we are reaping, I think, a very full harvest of what we might have hoped for. Quite a large number of people that are doing the reading. Tonight I am truly surprised to see that after we had 60 copies of the book to begin with, we bought another 12, and I'm looking at 3. So already two. Gone. we'll probably have to be ordering another set of those before too long, it looks like. But beyond just the fact that we have a lot of people who are doing the reading, you know, I have found that this kind of binds the congregation together. Because we're doing this work at home as much as we are in the class, everybody's mind is being filled in the whole congregation with similar material at all times. We're all working throughout the week with similar ideas. And so, for instance, we are also reaping this crop in which interest is being provoked and questions are being asked. I failed Bruce entirely here. He came to me almost a week ago now. And, well, he wrote a letter, an email, you know, asking a question about the material from last week, how Abraham is identified as an Amorite. And I thought, wow, that was a really well-written letter. He's got some excellent ideas there. Unhappily, the man's asking me to study. You know how little I like to do that. I'm going to really have to work on this one. And so I have not gotten to it yet. But just the fact that he's, you know, engaging the information as we all are, and then other things are coming to light that is causing us to think about it, of course, is doing us all the world good. I can't remember now if it was Carol or Leah, one of them had mentioned to me that this week that all the times they had been reading Genesis, all the times they had seen of Rachel and Leah and the price that was paid for Jacob in years in order to take them to wife, that the connection has just not quite been made, that he had to wait 7 years for the first wife. He promised to work 7 more years for the second wife, but did he have to wait 14 years to have his second wife? No, he only waited a week for her. So he worked the 7 years, that's a real long engagement, and then, you know, he took Leah to wife by deceit, we'll see that, and then when, you know, it all came to light, he was justifiably angry. He only had to wait 1 week before he then was married to the woman that he thought he was married to the first time. And these kinds of things, I believe, for you are going to be hopping out of the page every day. Now, one more thing. You've heard me mention it so many times, the 3 years that I've been with you. By the way, 4 days from now, we'll mark the third year anniversary that I've been preaching to the congregation here. So on the 19th of July, I preached my first lesson ever here. And so we're looking at 3 years, in which I forgot the point I was about to make. How did I start that? Read out loud. Many times you've heard me say that much more will happen in your mind if you read out loud. I have been trying to do my reading out loud. No, it's not home. Read out loud. And every time I do that, stuff jumps out at me because I'm forced to articulate it. It engages brain cells that aren't connected when you're reading silently. Something different will happen there. So the very best of your ability, read out loud if you can. All right, with all that in view here then, let's plunge into the work itself. So, this will be week 3, as I've just said. We've been reading this last week, pages 35 through 50. Pages 35 through 50 encompass Genesis chapter 25 through 36. However, typically I will try to do some kind of a connection in each class with the preceding class. And so tonight I'd actually like you to turn back to page 18. Let's go into last week's reading at page 18, and we'll read a paragraph there that I did not read it in that class, but it's the very first paragraph on page 18, upper left-hand corner there. The term patriarch refers to the founder or ruler of a tribe, a family, or a clan. The Israelites traced their ancestry to one man, the patriarch Abraham, as he's called in Isaiah and Hebrews. They laid claim to Canaan, this tribe did, under that patriarch, laid claim to Canaan, based on the covenant God made with their first three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to possess the land, which we'll read much later in Deuteronomy 1, verse 8. The phrase, the patriarchs, eventually referred to Jacob's 12 sons as well. You'll see the plural term there in Acts 7. Thus, among figures of the Bible, the patriarchs were the ancestors of the Israelites from Abraham to Jacob's son, Joseph. Now, that's the standard convention that people will use in the religious world, in Bible studies. Who are the patriarchs? The patriarchs are Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their descendants through to Joseph. These are the patriarchs. After that period of time, we'll be turning to a different way of designating, you know, a subsequent period of time. Now then, I did read part of this last week, but let's go ahead and go to the next page 19 there. And the fifth paragraph is the one in the left-hand column at the bottom right under the purple biblical literature title. Let's get this again. The second part of the book of Genesis, which is chapters 12 through 50, tells stories of Israel's patriarchs. The events from the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in chapters 12 through 38 take place primarily in Canaan. Although Abraham originated in Mesopotamia, Haran, I was never sure how to pronounce that. The traditions concerning these ancestors are grouped into cycles of stories which revolve around Abraham, chapters 12 through the middle of 25, and then around Jacob, chapter 25 through chapter 36. Isaac appears in the Abraham and Jacob cycles with much of his story in Genesis chapter 26. So, what we're doing here is trying to think in terms of outlines and categorizing and placing chronologically and understanding terminology. Here is, so far, the outline that we've looked at. In Genesis, the first 24 chapters, you have three chapters that speak of creation. And, of course, temptation and fall as well. We then have a chapter on Adam's descendants, which includes the story of the murder of Abel. We then spend chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 with Noah and the flood. Chapter 10 is a genealogy about Noah's descendants, followed in the first half of chapter 11 with the Tower of Babel story, and the last half, another genealogy, Shem's descendants. Then, we saw last week, chapters 12 through 24, these stories about Abraham. Now, what have we seen? God's telling us, through a prophet he called by the name of Moses, many years after the fact, but now inspired by the Holy Spirit, to write what he didn't witness. He wasn't there for the creation, but he's telling us what did take place. We are being told about everything from the earth, the universe formation, down through somebody's family. Whose family is it? Abraham's family. We are being brought down through this early history so we can get to that man. Now that we've got Abraham, everything in the Bible is flowing out of that man because he was selected to be the forefather not only of all who will be known as Jews, Hebrews, or Israelites. These three designations speak of the identical same people. Everyone is a direct descendant of Abraham through Isaac. Everybody else in the world, people that are not related by blood to that man Abraham, they will be known not as Jews, but as Gentiles. What, by the way, as you may know, what the word Gentiles, Greek term, actually means, if you were to translate it, do you know what the word is? Native. The word itself is ethnos, E-T-H-N-O-S. Sound familiar? It is our word ethnic. It means nations. But it's in the plural, and when it's in the plural, generally, it is referring to all nations except the nation that's descended from Abraham down through Isaac. Now, as a matter of fact, are the Israelites a nation? Yes. Does the term ethnos sometimes include them? Yes, it does. So don't think that it's a formal term that always exclusively means non-Jew. It doesn't. It means nation, or in the plural, nations. Sometimes the Jews are included among the nations that are being discussed. Usually they're not, because they're a special and separate nation. Now, let's break it down yet again. So here's those same chapters about Abraham now. Instead of putting them all together, chapter 12, the first time that the promise is given, he'll be father of many nations, he'll have land, and there'll be many people, and those that curse him will be cursed, and those that bless him will be blessed, and him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That promise appears for the first time. And in that same chapter, for the first time, he will say, very deviously, that his wife is his sister. Is she? Now, in fact, she is. She is his what sister? Half-sister. Chapter 13, they will make an exodus, and they will enter into Canaan. Chapter 14, his brother's son Lot and the high priest Melchizedek will be the principal players in that chapter. Then in chapter 15, the promise will be repeated now. Actually, in 15, that's the third time the promise is made. It's in chapter 13 as well. Third time, and this time we read also about a covenant. Then in chapter 16, we have the story of Hagar, another of Abram's wives. But through her is born what man? Ishmael. Ishmael is a blank brother to Isaac. He is a half-brother to Isaac. There's a lot of half-sees going on in the book of Genesis. So then, in chapter 17, the promise is repeated yet again, and circumcision is introduced as a fill-in-the-blank what of the covenant? It is the sign, thank you, of the covenant. So these special people are going to be designated by this particular sign. Now, if you've been reading the additional information blocks that were all around the text as we were coming through that material, are these Hebrews the only people on the planet who practice this rite of circumcision? No. Other people were circumcising too. It's not entirely unique to them. They're not even the first to do it. But it is what God set as the sign of their particular covenant. Chapters 18 and 19, the promise is repeated yet again. And we have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which everybody knows so well, but few people in America seem to have learned much from. Chapter 20, for a second time, tries to pass off Sarah, as his sister. And he's unsuccessful the second time, too. You'd think the guy would learn. Then, in chapter 21, Isaac is born and trouble ensues. Chapter 22, he's asked to sacrifice Isaac and prove his faith, which he not only does, but we will learn in the Hebrew letter, he was able to attempt to kill his son Isaac because there was something going on in his head, the Hebrew writer tells us. Why was he able to go ahead and kill that boy for sure? That is correct. He believed, Hebrews tells us, that if I'm going to have children from this son, then I'm going to have children from this son because God said so. I can kill him and still have children from this son. Then why? Resurrection was what was in his head. So then, after that, chapter 23, Sarah dies. She is buried. The cave of Machpelah is purchased as a family cemetery from that time forward. And for several generations, these descendants of Abraham will find their way eventually into the cave of Machpelah. Chapter 24, a bride is selected for Isaac, and that is where we ended last week. So overall, to take the whole book, looking not only backwards but forwards now, we have 11 chapters that have three main stories: creation, flood, Babel. We then have 13 chapters on Abraham. We are about to look at 10 chapters on Jacob. Oh, that's not right. Jacob. Good thing there aren't too many math quizzes in the Bible. And then in chapter 37 through 50, we're going to hear about Joseph. All right. Now, Joseph won't figure tonight, but we'll get to him next week. So let's begin with material that you started for this week on page number 35. I'd like to read that transition. These transitions are great. When you get done with this book, you can go back once a year and just read the transitions. And it would do you a world of good. Because it is the transitions that act like those little keyring links, you know, that we all used to use, where you got half circles on a hinge, you know, and they clip together and you put your keys on them. You know, it's clipping together the scriptures themselves. So if you just got the long chain of transitions there, it would guide you in a condensed version of the whole Bible. This transition says in the upper left corner of page 35, regarding the close of Abraham's life. Genesis presents a concluding summary of Abraham's story before beginning that of his son Isaac and his grandson Jacob. Abraham, who was 100 years old when Isaac was born, was 140 years old when Isaac was married, and 160 years old when Isaac fathered Abraham's grandson Jacob. Sometime during the 38 years between Sarah's death and Abraham's death, Abraham married Keturah, one of his concubines. Ancient Near Eastern custom was for a man to divide his property among his sons before he dies. The major portion went to Isaac, Abraham's second son, born to his full wife, Sarah, who was also his half-sister, with smaller gifts to the other sons. This patriarch died at age 175. So the story of Abraham in 13 chapters will conclude, and now we'll move in to this next section with Isaac. Now let's read though Genesis 25 verses 7 and 8. They're about the middle of the page on the left hand side, where it says, "This is the sum of the years of Abraham's life which he lived, 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people." We're all going down that road. We are all headed for Machpelah's cave. And so Abraham takes his place in the grand scheme of history. And did he ever? Okay? What is Abraham to the Bible story? He is everything. He is the perfect example of faith. He is also, on a number of occasions, quite a failure. Makes some silly mistakes. Gets himself in all kinds of trouble. Perfect example for the rest of us, you know, is Abraham. And in Abraham, promises are given in chapter 12, 13, 15, 17, 19. These, remember, they're all the odd chapters. This man is, in God's plan, the beginning of a huge period of time in which a certain people have been called out of the rest of the world to be completely unique and different. They will live under a different religious system. They will have different moral values. They will have only one God in the midst of the pantheism and pluralism that you find throughout the world, everywhere they go. They will be a shining light, a city on a hill, is what God intended for them in all the world for a good long time. And Abraham, he pulled it off. Died with a grin on his face, is what it sounds like. Did the job, did it well, and I'm going to go to my grave well satisfied, full of years, and that's just the way we all want to go. Now, let's see how his boys do. Okay? He did his job. We're going to go on now and look at the rest. Now, if everybody will look back up on the screen here, I'm going to put up a couple of these charts. I've shown them to you before in various contexts. But again, it's just kind of fun and interesting and to see the lifespans of these men. So on this particular one, here's Adam, and he dies at the age of 930. Seth dies at 9:12. Enosh dies at 9:05. Kenan dies at 9:10. Mahalalel at 895. Jared at 962. Enoch, when did he die? How old was he? Trick question. He didn't die at all. Well, after 65 years, he never died. This man was taken up into heaven because he was so righteous. Then we have Methuselah at 969, and finally Noah down here at 950. In that list, having really only two guys that are anomalies. Enoch, who leaves at 365, and Lamech, for reasons we're never told, who dies at the spring chicken ripe young age of only 777 years. The guy got cheated out of 200 years, didn't he? But there you go. This black is in the yellow to say, wow, that's really noticeable. God wanted us to understand the first generation, the first 10 generations, which are listed in the Bible, what we're told about in the Bible, were living out there to 900-year spans, and well beyond 900 years. This brings us, of course, to the flood, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I'm going to take you to the second chart now. This chart is the one that's in my New American Standard Bible. I've been using this chart, you know, just extensively in my teaching for years and years now. It's the best chart I've ever seen. It does exactly the same thing. And so here we go again, you know, the Adam, the Canaan, the Hallowell, you know, and you see that. That here is 950 years, and there with Noah, the 10th generation is listed in the book. You know, everybody's got real long bars. And then suddenly what happens right here? Boom, boom, boom. We get four guys. One lives to 600, 350 years less than the man before him. Then we get 438, 433, and 464. Another 150-60 years have dropped off. Everybody wants to know why. And we don't have an answer given in Scripture. But it's not hard to see. From the minute the death line was drawn, everybody lived a couple of hundred years less than they had been before. What is the line mark? The flood. Prior to the flood, including Noah, 900 plus is the norm. After the flood, instantly, we lose 500 years on a lifespan. Wow! And then, what happens after just those four? What happens in here? Another 200 years. Gone. These four guys only lived 239 years, 230, 205, and it's getting even less. 148, 175, 180, 147. Wow! What happened? Do we know? In this case, not at all. However, these are the people that are just before and just after Abraham. Does that mean something? I do not know. But now, we have come down to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The last three lines. 175, 180, and 147 years, respectively. Here's Jacob's outline. Jacob, in chapter 25, is going to be the fruit of Isaac's sons. But in chapter 25, we have Ishmael and the sons of Isaac. Chapter 26, Isaac is for the third time in the Bible, going to say what about his wife? My sister. This time, is she? Not even at all. What is he doing? He is prevaricating. Okay. How's that spelled in three letters? He's a liar. That's what that guy is. What?
Well, you explained last week, I think, how family relationships, someone could still be considered your brother or sister if they were a little ways away. So wasn't she still technically a sister? And she was the daughter of his uncle or something like that.
Well, there you got me. Did I get that wrong? No, oh, I know what you're saying.
I understand what you're saying. It is so, and we mentioned this last week, that the term son is not limited very exclusively to only one term, which means direct next generation descendant. Sometimes son can mean what?
brother, relative, cousin. It is. It's a little more. And yes, she is coming from another branch of the family, isn't she? Okay, right. But insofar as how we would define it, is she his sister in our terms? No. Is she his sister in Abimelech's terms? She isn't his sister in anybody's terms. He's still just making that one up, as far as everybody, you know, can be remotely concerned. Chapter 27, Jacob steals the blessing from his brother. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. Wow! Chapter 28, we get God's first promise to Jacob. Chapter 29, we have Jacob and Laban and all the, you know, family intrigue with Rachel and Leah. Chapter 30, Jacob's children are now introduced. In 31, Jacob's going to flee from Laban. There was real bad blood going on there at the end with his daddy-in-law. Chapter 32, Jacob's name will be changed, and it's changed to what? Israel. In chapter 33, Jacob and his brother Esau, they get their act together. It's going to take them 20 years, but after 20 years, they will reconcile. And it will be full and free and complete. They're going to be very happily working together as brothers again. And then Dinah gets raped. And there's one of the ugliest stories in all the Bible. Then comes chapter 35. We have a second time that God offers expresses the promise to Jacob. God is repeating this promise many times to all of these people. And then lastly, in chapter 36, we then get another genealogy, Esau's descendants. Why are all these genealogies here? So we can see that God is tracing a lineage that goes right down the line from whom?
Abraham.
Who is the father of all, not all, but many nations. And what particular nation? Israel the Jews. Okay, no more charts for tonight. Now we're just going to go down through the text. All of this, you know, God's taken here. So we have some outlines. Now everybody, page 35. And if you're note takers, you have to squeeze a lot in here. You know, if you're trying to put it in the Bible, I really had to work at it myself. You might want to have separate that piece of paper. But I think it's important for you to see, in the right-hand column, right in the middle, there is an indented section, which is Genesis 25, verse 23. Let's read Genesis 25, 23. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. And the older shall serve the younger. Now, in this birth, first, twins have always been an unusual thing. Not impossible, not miraculous, but, you know, they are unusual. So she's told for the event, this is twins. They didn't have ultrasound in those days. So she's being told miraculously, I'm going to have twins. When she's told that, these twins are two what? Nations they are. Oh, there's going to be these two boys, long descendants, separating, demarcating entirely new nations. Two people shall be separated from your body. And most unusual now, one people shall be stronger than the other. Well, that's not so unusual, but that the older will serve the younger. Do we just do that in these days? No, we don't do that. That's even more amazing than that she might have twins. That just never happens. Whoa, that's most interesting. Now, when I say note-taking, I turn my Bible so I can read it. The first fulfillment of that prophecy, and that's what it is a prophecy. The first fulfillment is on the next page in the same chapter 25 at verses 29 through following. On the same page at verse 29. So the bottom there where it says Esau sells his birthright. Let's read it. Jacob cooked the stew. Esau came in from the field. He was weary. Esau said to Jacob, feed me with that same red stew, for I'm weary. Therefore his name was called Edom. And Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. reasonable price for a meal, I guess. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die, so what is this birthright to me? Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. So he swore to him, sold his birthright to Jacob. Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. He ate, drank, arose, and went his way. And thus Esau did what with his birthright? He despised his birthright. He did not value it highly enough. He gave it away for far too little. That was one weak moment, to say the very least. And it is also fulfillment number one here in the Genesis chapters of the prophecy that the older will serve the younger. Who just got the birthright? Older or younger? The younger just got the birthright. Second fulfillment is in chapter 27, that's the next page, verses 27 through 29. It's actually two pages over. So come to page 38. We're on Genesis 27, starting in verse 27. He came near, as Isaac did, and kissed him, and kissed Jacob. He smelled the smell of his clothing, blessed him, and said, surely, Isaac, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field. It is Jacob. Excuse me, Dan. Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of the field, which the Lord has blessed. Therefore may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you, nations bow down to you, be master over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, blessed be those who bless you. Here's a promise. It is also the fulfillment of that preceding prophecy. And the third time that fulfillment will take place is still on page 38, and starting down there in the right-hand column at the very bottom at verse 39. Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, now to Esau, behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. That's a good thing. By your sword you shall live. That's not so great. You shall serve your brother. That's not right at all. It shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck. That kind of contention and problems, you know, nobody wants. But what is it? It's the third time that we will have a fulfillment of the preceding prophecy. So just in the next couple of chapters, we are going to see the prophecy repeated. We are going to see it repeated to different people. We are going to see those subsequent generations fulfilling that prophecy in each their own time. God foretells the future. Now, any questions in chapter 25 about the selling of the birthright? Anybody? Skated on that one. Okay, let's go to chapter 26. In chapter 26, you have the first time the promise is given to Isaac in verse 2 of chapter 26. Left-hand column there, just past the middle. The Lord appeared in Genesis 26 to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Live in this land of which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, and I'll be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I give all these lands. I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father. I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I'll give your descendants all these lands. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So Isaac, why is life going to be so good for you that I would now repeat line by line the promise I first gave to Abraham in Genesis 12? I'm going to repeat it, and you're going to reap it. Is that because you're such a great kid? It's because I made a promise to your daddy. It's because I am a faithful God. I said this will happen, and it will. So I am repeating myself. You just watch and see. If I give my word will be fulfilled. Then, now just for fun here, 26 and verse 8, excuse me, 6 it is, last paragraph on the left-hand column on page 36. So Isaac dwelt in Gerar, and the men of the place asked about his wife. He said, she's my sister. He was afraid to say she's my wife, because he thought, lest the men of the place kill me for Rebekah, because she is beautiful to behold. Now it came to pass, when he'd been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window, saw, there was Isaac, showing endearment. Respectful way to say what he saw. and to Rebekah's wife, Abimelech called Isaac and said, quite obviously, she's your wife. So how can you say she's my sister? And Isaac said to him, because I said, lest I die on account of her. And Abimelech said, well, okay, I can understand that, no sweat. Now, what did he say? What is this you've done to us? One of the people might soon have lain with your wife. You would have brought guilt on us. So Abimelech charged all of his people, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely what? We're going to kill him. Okay? Did these rotten old Gentiles who've never heard a word, you know, from the Lord and just lived in gross immorality have any kind of an appreciation or respect for marriage? I'm sure they did. Because these old rotten Gentiles who never, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are all descended ultimately from whom? Adam and Eve. They're all part of the family of humankind. Does God love any of them less than the others? No. Oh, he may have different purposes for these descendants of Abraham. He still cares about these others. How these others had this knowledge of these morals is a study that you can get into in Roman letter and other places. We won't do it tonight. Several different ways that can happen. But nonetheless, they knew such things. Did it matter to them? Enough to put a death penalty on it. She dare touch that woman. And don't you ever do that to me again. Yeah, I said they respected marriage. Murder, on the other hand. Okay. See, I can't account for all those things because I'm a kid, but yet, that was a very real concern. And if it wasn't, would he have done this? No, with a high probability. Yeah, I did. They were rough times. They really were. So, I'm not excusing anything anybody did. Oh, and thank you so much for that comment, because I meant to say this earlier. And so we'll just put it in right here now. Okay, the Bible tells the story, fill in the blank, blank and all. Starts with a W. Warts and all. Okay, and is therefore one of innumerable proofs that the Bible is telling you the truth. If these Bible writers are just making it up, are they going to make themselves look bad? No, and one of the starkly true things that the archaeologists and all have discovered, when they go digging through, you know, the Sumerians and the Akkadians and all these other peoples, clay tablets and cuneiform and papyri from the Egyptians and all this other stuff, you know, that they found. They read thousands of pages from antiquity going back to the same time frame as these people that are written about in the Bible. And with all those records, how do these people always describe themselves? Wartless. Okay? And then you get to the Bible, and what do you see? Well, look at there. They're just telling us, even when it reflects very poorly on them. So next time you hear some guy romping and stomping and sounding like he knows what he's talking about, he says, why, if we all follow the Bible, we'd be raping Diana and marrying our sisters. When they're doing that, you know, it's just a grand display of ignorance in the first place. The Bible is not suggesting that these things ought to be done. The Bible isn't saying, let's all run out and do evil when it is evil. What is the Bible doing? Admitting that people do evil things, even in the descendants of Abraham, who are the chosen of God's people. And so it's just, you know, one of these many proofs that you have honesty here, you have veracity here, you have truthfulness here. Yes?
Is that why you think that instead of saying she's my sister, that the Middle East has decided to cover up the women so that you can't see anything?
I don't know where that came from, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to work Bruce's problem before yours. Yeah, I can't tell you on that one. Okay, so now, let's move on over to chapter 27 would be on the right-hand side of verse 30, page 37 rather. So in Genesis 27, we have this blessing that Isaac bestows upon Jacob. You're all familiar with it. You're familiar with the deception. Whose idea was it? Yeah, who was? Wife to one and mother to the other. Okay, there was a wonderful woman in the king family relations. Okay, and so she concocts this plan. Her son is not happy about the idea, but he agrees to it because his mom urges him so. And between the two of them, they collude together to lie in the most dramatic way and to deceive their husband and father, Isaac, so that they trick him into doing what, according to the previous prophecy? Fulfilling the prophecy. Okay? So it's not like these people were setting out very consciously to do this, but that's the power of the prophecy. Who can anticipate a generation ago that these as yet unborn twins in your womb are going to have a reversal of birthright and authority in the family, and when the younger is going to rule over the older? Who can see all of this? Not in advance, save for God. Then we see it played out in biblical history. It's a horrible chapter. The Bible is not suggesting that you must follow this chapter to the T and therefore do all you can to steal your brother's inheritance. It's his blessing. It's not teaching that. It's just saying, here's how the prophecy was fulfilled, but God wasn't asking anybody to sin in the process. But it is how it played out.
When Esau and Jacob were not yet born, and their mother was told that older will serve the younger, and then Esau gave away his birthright, was this all from God, or was the prophecy just telling this is what's going to happen?
See, and again, my understanding is that God, in no place in Scripture, has ever asked or suggested, encouraged, or commanded that anybody commit a sin. That does not happen. Is God even capable of such a thing? No. But in the shenanigans and sinfulness of mankind, and often enough despite it, but sometimes as a direct result too, does God's will get done? Yes. Why? Quote Romans for me. All things work together for good to those who love the Lord. Okay? So, Bill, you see the problem. He's not encouraging anybody to sin. He's not making these things happen by way of, did God force Judas against his will to betray Jesus? No. We just studied this. What was Jesus apparently doing at the Last Supper with Judas? Giving you his last chance not to do this terrible thing. But still, what did the man choose to do? What the prophecy had said he would. Because God knows the end from the beginning. Okay? Ted, did you have a hand up?
Isn't that the whole point of God's omniscience, though? God didn't say specifically in the prophecy that he was commanding sin. But God knew it was going to happen and fulfill the prophecy. That's the whole point of God's prophecy. Is that he knows what's going to happen because he's God.
Yeah.
And whether or not they fulfill in a righteous manner or in a sinful manner, it doesn't matter if the prophecy is fulfilled.
If Doc Brown put me into a silver DeLorean, and I raced off, you know, into the future, and while I was there, I discovered that three boys between the ages of 10 and 12 were going to burn down the stadium. And then I come back and I say, three boys are going to burn down the stadium. Did I make them do it?
No.
This is what Ted is saying. Okay? Now, in these next chapters, we have the continuing saga of these amazing stories in which God's plan is fulfilled through a number of providential activities. You read them. It's all we know about them. And they're interesting and self-evident when you read them. So, I've got 10 minutes left anyway. We're just going to go and look skip over rather some of these chapters here. Jacob meets Rachel under very unusual circumstances. How did Jacob meet Rachel 1,000 miles from home?
His brother wanted to kill him
for what he had done. And I got to tell you, I'm on Esau's side in that deal. Okay, he got cheated big time. Okay, so he wanted to kill him. And Jacob had to run for his life. He meets Rachel. He meets Leah. He himself is totally deceived. So he winds up waking up the next morning married to a woman he never asked for and didn't want.
But it's the custom of the land. No kidding. Now you tell me. Now, any of this, God saying this is the way I want it to happen? Ted, say no.
No. No, but it is what happened. Old Laban, he's quite a guy.
He's this cheating, conniving skunk with household idols to boot.
You read about this guy and you say, oh, you wouldn't want to live within 100 miles of such a man. Okay, so we hear about all, the unhappiness, but ultimately, what does it result in? Jacob is now married to the beautiful woman he wanted, and his sister, that was a big surprise, and then he also has become financially what? Oh, he's big time. Okay? He's well set. And also, in desperate need of what with regard to Laban? Time to get out of Dodge, Jimmy. This is not going to work much longer. So he takes off, makes Laban mad. Laban chases him. God talks to Laban. Don't you see anything good or bad to this guy? They work out their little date hunt. And thereby, Jacob leaves with the wives and the household idols that he never knew he had. Did God ever suggest that idolatry was a good thing? No. But Laban was practicing it. Not helpful, but the fact. Somebody had a hand up over here.
Saber. Bill, your quota's passed.
I only got 10 minutes left, man. I'm sorry.
Rachel, Jacob's wife, was related to Laban. And it seems to me that family has legal problems. They were always trying to cheat.
Yeah. If they had reality television in those days, I'm thinking the network channel is going to be coming out of Hayran or Banana Radio. So yeah, it's just amazing. Jacob's name is changed to what?
Israel.
His name will become Israel. From that point on, everybody's name will be Israel. Now, by the way, I wanted to do this earlier, so we'll do it right now. Everybody go back to page 41. At the very bottom of the left-hand column, underneath the horizontal black line, what word do you see repeated over and over and over and over again?
Literally.
Okay? Make sure you watch for those. They'd be pretty easy to miss. There's such microscopically tiny print at the bottom of the page. But biblical names are fascinating. So, what page was I just telling you to be on there? Yeah, okay, 41. Now, look at the bottom of 42 in the right-hand column. Three more literallys. Turn the page. Go look at the right-hand column, bottom 44. More literallys. Left-hand column, page 45, literally. Turn to page 46, literally. Turn to the next page, literally. Look at the next page, 48 we're on now. Literally. Okay? Bible names always what?
Meant something. It was not just a clinking, clattering collection of... How is that? Collisionist junk. That's how it went. It's not just a collection of mellifluous sounds, which is what we do in America so much. Shaniqua. Why do people name it? Well, it sounded good. It's unusual. A Bible name carries what with it?
Meaning.
Mom and Dad thought about it. Or else, God chose the name because he had a reason. It was going to mean something in the future.
So Bible names are very, very, very interesting. We're not going to take the time to go look at them all, and you see how many times that literally appears, but read those. Whenever you see a footnote, go look for it. You know, see what it says. And you'll see just in the naming of the children, in the naming of places, in the naming of circumstances, you're going to see lessons being taught in the translation of a single word. Then, let's come over to page 48. And on page 48, in the right-hand column, which is chapter 35, please go to Genesis 35, verse 9, about two-thirds of the way down that right-hand column. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padanaram, blessed him, and God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. Also God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I give to you and to your descendants after you. I give this land." And God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him Bethel. What does Bethel mean, literally?
House of God.
House of God. Okay? So you see, again, even circumstances, the places are named after something that takes place there, so that as Israel will now go forth for centuries to live in this land, everywhere they look, what are they going to see? Monuments that will call attention to what? Divine circumstances, the fulfillment of prophecies, miraculous events in some cases, God leaving these memorials throughout Israel to be reminding these people who they were, where they came from. Alright? That was our last, oh by the way, that was what we just read, is the second promise to Jacob. These promises are not only given, they are repeated time and again throughout these chapters. Now, after I skipped over so many things, rape, Dinah, you know, not the least of which. So, any comment or question? We've got just a couple of minutes. Okay, go ahead.
Chapter 31, verse 43.
Everybody, Genesis 31, 43 will be found over here on page 44. Laban answered and said to Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters, these children are my children, the flock's my flock, all you see is mine." Okay? "What can I do this day to these daughters or to their children whom they have borne? Now therefore, come, let's make a covenant, you and I, let it be a witness between you and me." Okay. Let's answer it this way. Where is it now? In one of the information blocks, it's above on that page, on page 44, look at the second paragraph under Family Leadership and Household Gods, look at the second paragraph. Laban's accusation provoked reaction from Jacob centered on his mistreatment while with Laban. Jacob went so far as to claim that it was God alone who provided his wealth. That included the wives. He got nothing from Laban, is what he argued in verse 42, the verse before you're reading. Then it says, Laban disputed that claim and suggested that all that Jacob possessed, including his wives, was actually Laban's. Certainly, the two men could not agree on who owned what. Okay, now, I want you all to look at the most beautiful woman in this room, sitting right there behind Bob Johnson, and I married her. Okay? Now, she belonged to me or her parents? She didn't belong to her parents. So what do we got? Do the parents have a claim on her? Yeah, they do. Do I have a claim on her? Who gets to win?
Yeah.
Okay? But is it unfair of me, you know, to say that the parents have no claim on her? They are, after all, for what? Her parents. And what did Jacob do in the night with Laban's daughters?
Three days out. Okay. Is that the way you leave your father-in-law? Laban got a beef? Jacob got a beef? Both guys right? Both guys wrong? Yeah. Who made it happen? Who wanted Jacob to get a wife, a whole lot of money, and go home? God did. Okay? So let's sit around and argue about it all day. Who's right, who's wrong? She's my sister. No, she isn't. Okay. Okay. So what are we going to do about this now? We've got to argue all you want. But here's the deal. Jacob, go home. Take the wife with you. Okay? Answer the question. And he did it.
Okay. By the way, you know, obviously there's my time. But hey, if you're ever in a really bad scrape with somebody, what Jacob did when he met the 400 armed soldiers of Esau, was that smart or what? Let's put kids and innocent children in the front. What would we say about that thing? Well, how are you going to kill kids and innocent children? See, wave after wave, and what finally happened? I give up. Come on, let's be friends again. Okay, good stop.
When the promise is repeated, because Abraham was the seed of many nations, every time it's repeated, it narrows the focus each time to the individual. So it's not just a repetition of the promise, it's a designation of who out of all of Abraham's children was the promise given.
Yeah, Carol's absolutely right. It is. It's narrowing down. We don't have many children, each one. You know, many five. One is singled out. If anything, we're trying to get the one. Who's the one? Jesus the Christ, Son of the living God, and child of Abraham. Okay?